Hello, everyone, and welcome to Working in the Weeds, a podcast from the UF IFAS Center for Aquatic and Invasive Plants. My name is Jay Farrell, and I'm the director. And across from me, as always, is our communications manager and co-host, Christine Krebs.
Hi, everyone. Happy to be here.
So today, we're looking forward to a great interview with someone that everybody already knows. When I became director, I started talking to people about, all right, who do I need to connect with? Who can I work with to start making connections and learning more about the invasive species world? And everybody said the same thing, is you have to go talk to Chuck Bargeron at Bugwood at the University of Georgia. So everybody knows Chuck. He's been involved in everything from one coast to the next, and we're really pleased to have you with us today.
No, thank you. Thank you for that introduction. I've been a fan of the podcast, and so it's an honor to be on it and to be able to talk to y'all about the stuff that we do here at the University of Georgia, and to be able to bridge that Georgia Florida rivalry and still get along and have a good conversation.
Well, there is no rivalry because Florida, we don't play football anymore. We are a baseball school now. So there's no football rivalry, so we don't have to worry about that. But Chuck, like I said, everybody already knows you, but tell us a little bit about yourself and your background and how you ended up in the place you are.
Yeah, it's an interesting story. So when I was looking for a summer job between my senior year of high school and my first year of college, I had somebody reach out to me. They were looking for somebody that knew something about computers. And so I started working for Keith Dowse, who was a professor of forest entomology at the University of Georgia. I worked for him for that summer, went off to college for a couple of quarters. That didn't quite work out. I ended up back in Tifton at ABAC and went back to work for him and for Dave Moorhead, who was the extension forester for UGA. And they had started this project where they were collecting slides. This was mid-90s. We were in the transition from slide projectors to PowerPoint presentations. And so they had started collecting these 35-millimeter slides and scanning them, digitizing them, and getting them into a format that they could be used in PowerPoint. And so I came on to help with that process. I ended up doing my senior project in computer science was designing the database structure for that, for the database of these pictures. It worked out that I was graduating and I needed a job, and I was like, I'll go back to Tifton and do this for a few years. I'd worked remotely at Georgia Southern when I was finishing my undergraduate, and I'll go back to Tifton and do this for a few years. And we took the database that I designed as my senior project and ended up making it a web application. And so in 2001, we launched the Forestry Images website with 3,500 pictures. That's expanded to include a weed images and insect images and IPM images and the invasive.org website. And now we have over 300,000 pictures in that time frame. And it went from us begging for slides to us collecting these slides. And so that was kind of how I got started at the university. The other part of my job when I first started was the CAPS program, the Cooperative Agricultural Pest Survey Program, which is something that every state has, and it was tied to the universities. It's kind of stayed in the Department of Ag's more now, but it started at working with universities, and they would do surveys on high consequence pests, insect mainly pests in the state. And so I worked on that data and learned that piece. Later, I went back and got my master's in computer science. That allowed me to become a faculty member with the university. I realized that I was working for an entomologist and a forester that were both going to retire before I was. And so if I got my master's and became a faculty member, then I could pursue grants and continue the program past them. So that's where the Bugwood name came from, because we were originally focused in entomology and in forestry. And so that we needed a short URL. And so Bugwood was where that came from. And then later we became more official and became the Center for Invasive Species and Ecosystem Health.
Well, that's what I was wondering if you were going to get there, because everybody knows Chuck, and everybody knows Chuck because everybody's heard of Bugwood, because everybody has used pictures from there. And now Bugwood has grown over the years. It has matured from those few little images you guys were collecting back years ago to now the Center for Invasive Species and Ecosystem Health. It is a much bigger concept, and you being the director there really shows that you have done, and you've done the yeoman's work of not only putting the pieces together, but bringing people together to use this website and all of these resources. And to your point, at one point you were begging people to send slides, and now people willingly come together and share their images with you because they know that's where everybody goes first.
It's been a great process. I've met a lot of very interesting people in doing this. It's kind of interesting that at some point along the way, invasive plants became a big deal for forest health. And so Jim Miller, who was with the Forest Service at Auburn, and others were starting to do work on how do we handle invasive plants as far as health issues. And so we started collecting pictures of these invasive plants and built a resource. And that's where we realized that there was nobody at a national level doing a good job of tracking the distribution of these species. And so there have been some great projects. There was an invasive plant atlas of New England, and there were some other things that were around that were doing part of this, but we were putting together information about the worst invasive plants in the United States, and there were not good distribution maps to go along with them. And so that is what led to us developing the EDMAP system. And it's interesting because we have people now that know EDMAPs and don't know Bugwood, or know Bugwood and don't know EDMAPs. But you mentioned the partnerships. When I talk about what I do IT and I do partnerships, because if you don't have those relationships with the different organizations, then you don't have the trust there where you can share information and share resources and help solve problems when new problems come up.
Well, and you're talking about how Bugwood turned into the center and all the things that it has done. I mean, I think you guys are managing and helping maintain 100 some odd websites for sister institutions and other groups. You've got this massive suite of apps, but one of the marquee products is the EDMAPs. So would you talk a little bit about what that app is, where it came from, whose brainchild was it, and how did this thing take the legs that it's got now? To your point, they know it without knowing the center, and that without knowing Bugwood, which is amazing to me.
Right. And so we started EDMAPs in 2005, 2006 timeframe was really when things started getting going with it. It was initially going to be focused on the southeastern United States, kind of to fill in the Southeast Exotic Pest Plant Council footprint. There was the Invasive Plant Atlas of New England, and there was an Invasive Plant Atlas of the Mid-South, and we were going to try to fill in that void. So that's kind of how we got started. What happened was, once people figured out that we were doing mapping and we were doing those kind of things, then it started expanding into different areas. So one of the first areas we worked was in the Everglades, with the Everglades Cooperative Invasive Species Management Area, and just having a form on their website where people could report invasive species. This was before the iPhone had come out. So we were doing this, you know, as a web-based form.
So EDMAP started with paper?
We were doing a little bit of paper, but it was basically mainly a web form. So, you know, there was always, you know, I love to tell the story about how you know, when you had an iPhone that you could put an app on and it had the GPS built in and it had the camera built in, then there was no longer a reason to carry all this equipment with you and then write stuff down and then have to go to the computer and enter it in the computer. So we started in the Everglades. Our next project was in Alaska. And then we just kind of started filling in areas between there. Because of the Python issue in South Florida, the National Park Service got entrance fee funding from Everglades National Park to put toward the Python funding 1 year. And so that was 2009, 2010. And one of the projects that came out of that was the I've Got One app. And so that was the first smartphone app that we did. I actually did a lot of the programming myself for the initial one. It started out as a field guide. We took a field guide that was done by the Everglades CISMA on non-native reptiles, and that was the initial app. When the Park Service funding came in, we said, we're not just going to build a Python app. We're going to build an invasive species in Florida app and include all the species. We worked with the Center for Aquatic and Invasive Plants and took y'all's flip guide and incorporated that text and pictures into the app at that point. And so the app came out not as a product of the University of Georgia, but as a collaboration between the Park Service, the University of Georgia, the University of Florida, the Nature Conservancy was involved as well, and Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission. So it was all about building that partnership. And then EdMaps and the EdMaps apps have grown from that.
So the idea here is to let people who are out doing either their job or folks that are out doing their leisure activities, when they see that invasive species, they document it on their phone and it helps with distribution maps. Now, how much pushback did you get here in the early days? You're talking early, you know, 2000s, how much pushback did you get when you were saying, hey, scientists, we are going to put this powerful technology in the hand of the layman and let them build these maps for us that only ecologists have ever built previously? Did you get pushback from that, or were people receptive of it from the beginning?
So from the beginning, we made sure that no information was made public without some level of expert reviewing it. And so the biggest concern we had at the beginning was that these experts were going to get overwhelmed with reports. And how were they going to find the time to do this and et cetera, et cetera. And so luckily, just because of how things like this happen, it was a slow process. So they weren't overwhelmed. And by the time it started to be at the point that we're at now, where we get close to 500 reports in the U.S. and Canada every single day, you know, I mean, spread out across the country, across the two countries. And the infrastructure was there by the time we got to this point where, you know, Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission has people on staff that respond to these reports when they come in. And so it's become that in a lot of places. Now, because of the awareness of the pythons and just invasive species in general in Florida, we get more reports from one-time reporters who have heard about I've Got One, who have heard about this, than we do in the rest of the country. Where in the rest of the country, we do have some volunteers that get really excited, but in a lot of cases, the system is being used more as a professional tool than it is in Florida. But we're working to change that. But, you know, every time a press release goes out in the state of Florida about invasive animals anyway, it says, you can call 1-888-I've-Got-One, you can report via the I've Got One website, or you can report via the I've Got One app. So that consistent marketing and that consistent branding of things really helps get the public involved. And other states have just not gotten to that level that we want to get them to yet.
Do you think there's a lot more opportunity within those other states because they have invasives, or do you think Florida is going to probably be that poster child because we just have so many instances of invasive species?
We've seen it in some other places. Ontario, our partner in Ontario is the Ontario Federation of Anglers and Hunters. And so because of that, they work with the people that are on the ground a lot. And so we do get a lot of those public reports from in Ontario. And there's other examples as well. I think I spent too much time in the early days of EdMaps focusing on trying to get people to report invasive species. And that was the wrong thing to do. I needed to focus on getting people to care about invasive species and recognize that this is a problem that is as big of an environmental problem as any of the other environmental problems that we're dealing with. And here's a way that you can help do something about this. And that was the thing, going back, Jay, to what you said earlier, is there's no reason to put a point on the map if it's not hopefully something going to be done about it at some point, or to help at least document how bad the problem is. Japanese honeysuckle in Georgia is everywhere. We're probably never going to get rid of it. But when we started this, we didn't even have it documented in every county in the state. And so to be able to look at that change, that you can't talk about how big a problem this is if you can't show a map that at least shows it in every county. And so there's a lot of different reasons to map, but one of them is hopefully because it's a way that the public can contribute to something that is a big environmental problem, and then it will help build the case for why we need to do something about this problem.
Yeah, you make a good point. When you're trying to get legislative support for some type of invasive species, oh, it's everywhere. It's terrible. Where are the maps? Well, we don't have it. Where are the data? We don't have it. This allows you to very directly and definitively say, this is the scope and the scale of the problem, and it is in your home county, legislator. So that is a powerful tool. Now, how has this thing been adopted within government? So are there, is like USGS or USDA APHIS, are those organizations using it to an official capacity?
So one of our biggest partners on this and biggest supporters on this has been the USDA Forest Service. And so we've worked with them both on the EdMaps and on a more citizen science focused system called WildSpotter. We've also worked with state governments and become the database of record for many state governments. Minnesota is an example, Utah is an example, and there's others where it's written into their code, it's written into their grant processes, where if they're going to get funding out, then part of what they have to do is submit data into EdMaps to use it. Utah has even built a tool that uses the data and uses a prioritization model to determine how they rank their grants based on the data that's going in for the state through EdMaps.
Well, Chuck, it just always blows my mind, and it just makes me chuckle every time I think about the fact that the leading voice in invasive species in the United States is a guy that doesn't even have a degree in biology of any sort. It's a computer scientist. But you have now taken this Bugwood concept, helped it grow, taken EdMaps from a web-based tool to something that is now in the hands of everybody out there, to the point of 500 different people a day sending in data points. So the center has grown, right? It basically, this Bugwood got too big to be Bugwood anymore, and now the center is in place. So EdMaps is a big part of it. I've Got One is a big part of it. But how broad is this center? What all are you guys involved in?
Yeah, and so the center is, I think I mentioned earlier, very much outreach focused, very much IT focused. The reason that we became a center was because we wanted the stability beyond just two faculty members' projects. And so when we became a center, it was so there would be a continuation of this beyond individuals. And so, you know, when we had retirements and of the original founders, Keith Dowse and Dave Moorhead, then that's when I came on as co-director and then director. a lot of our funding is external, is soft funds, as we call them within the university. We get a lot of funding from outside groups. That means we have a lot of different projects going on at one time. And so my job is more about administration and that part than it is about the biology. I also think it helps me do this job because I think of things that the way a non-biologist is going to think about it. And so what's needed because of the big area we work in is more of a generalist. And so I don't have to know the biology about every single species, because one day it's going to be a weed in Utah. The next day it could be a hornet in Georgia. And we just need to be able to help solve problems. And so that's the kind of things that we've done. So we did an app for the FBI and Homeland Security focused on noxious and poisonous seeds. So they had a product in their pocket that they can use to identify these in the field. And that has been what we've done in a lot of cases. Somebody comes to us with a problem and we go, okay, how can we solve this? Asian longhorn beetle was found in Ohio. The extension forester in Ohio reached out and said, we need an app for reporting Asian longhorn beetle. And I said, no, we're not going to do an app for reporting Asian longhorn beetle. We're going to do an app for reporting invasive species in this area. And so we've done a lot of that. The Squeal on Pigs campaign that was launched in the Pacific Northwest focused on those outer populations of wild pigs in the United States. That was a really cool name. You know, they had a really cool campaign around this. Let's take that campaign, build a smartphone app for it, and then integrate that into the campaign. Because in that case, wild pigs are different enough from what people normally consider and think about as invasive species that it made sense to do something different. And so we have a lot of different products and a lot of different tools, and that's just a few of them, but it's all been about working with different partners to figure out their needs and find a solution.
Well, one thing about technology is that it never stands still. So you guys have built some amazing tools that are really smart, that are making a difference and an impact. But can you spend a few minutes and talk about where is your head now? Looking into the future, what are the things you're wanting to build? What are some new technologies you're hoping to integrate? And if you can just kind of let us look at the horizon with you for a minute, it'd be really amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that there is obviously artificial intelligence is going to have a big impact on the future of these kind of things. We have not spent a lot of time focusing on building artificial intelligence into our applications yet, because I know taxonomists that argue over identification of grasses. And so a phone's never going to be able to probably identify a grass in the field. Now, you take a tree or you take a shrub with some distinct characteristics, and it can and it does. But Apple and Google are also building some of those tools into their operating systems. So instead of us spending, you know, 2 or 3 years and a lot of resources trying to build a tool like that, I'm hoping that's going to be a tool that's available that then we can integrate into what we're already doing. You know, the other thing is looking at augmented reality type applications where you're looking through some kind of headset, but then you still see what's going on around you. And so, you know, being able to go out in the field and use more like a pair of sunglasses, and as you look around, being able to see EdMaps points in the field, so you can go, okay, well, that's where that is, and let's go treat that. And you know, it's for anybody who's familiar with the Pokemon Go game, where these things exist out there, and then you interact with them. And I think, and this is where I've gotten involved in policy and I've gotten involved in these different organizations, is because we still don't have the manpower that we need, the volunteer power that we need to be able to get to record all these problems out there and then follow up on them. And so I love the technology part, and there's a lot of opportunity on the technology side, getting the education, doing the outreach, doing the marketing, and getting the public involved is more of where I'm looking at in the future than what cool technology we can do, because it's going to take a while before some of that is mainstream enough. It's taken us 10 plus years since the iPhones come out to be able to, you know, get it in the hands of most people. And when I say iPhone, I mean smartphone in general, but in the hands of more people and using it. Tools like the Apple Watch that allow you to do things without pulling a phone out of your pocket, I think have a lot of capabilities as well. But when I look at the future, it's more of thinking about how we get more people engaged. And I mentioned the Wild Spotter product, that one of the apps that we're doing that is really focused on citizen science. We took EdMaps and we said, EdMaps is built by scientists, for managers. How do we take this and make it something that will work for the general public? And so we completely stripped everything down, worked with a few partners, and said, how do we make this very simple? And it's no longer reporting how many square feet or how many acres of the species. It's the population the size of a basketball, the size of a car, or bigger than a bus. And so if you put it in that scale, then that's something that anybody, for a plant in particular, can look at and go, okay, well, it's a basketball. Okay, we know it's a small infestation. It's a football field size. It's a lot bigger than that. And so we're working with different land management agencies to implement this Wild Spotter program as a consistent message across all the agencies. So if you go in a national park, or you go in a state park, or you go to a national forest or wildlife refuge, they're going to see the same name. That's going to give them some memory of it. They're going to hopefully download the app and report things in the places that they love and the places that they visit. And I think that's the future. We're never going to eradicate every species from everywhere, but let's take care of these public lands that we truly care about and truly have at another level. And we've got to, through COVID, there was a big push for this, you know, recreate responsibly and leave no trace, and having the distance between you and being safe with COVID was all included. And we need to get the invasive species issue included in this recreate responsibly concept, where you're cleaning your boots, you're cleaning your equipment, and then if you see something, you tell somebody about it, or you report it through an app. And so that wasn't the answer to the question that you asked, but it's more of where I guess I see the next 15 years or more of my career being focused on is how do we continue to push this issue up, get the interest in it, that because it is a big problem that's costing us a lot of money, and it's more than just a niche field that a few people are working in.
Well, I've always hoped there would be some type of gamification that, okay, you're going to this national park, or you're going to some type of wildlands. There are this many points in here that you can potentially get if you go in and you identify these specific plants or these specific things that we're looking at. And the harder they are to identify, the more points they're worth. And hopefully, you know, oh goodness, Carrie from North Carolina, they've got 480 points on this trail. So I've always wondered if there was something like that that we could do to really get people interested and help them look, and being intentional while you're out there. These plants are bad. They are problematic. And if I can start cueing on them here, I can cue on them other places. And now that goes right back into your documentation. The more documentation we have, the better we can tell the message. These plants are ruining our natural environment. So hopefully we can continue down that path as well, just getting more people into looking and paying attention.
Absolutely. And exactly what you said, you've got to have enough baseline data that exists for these areas. So these there are points that they can go back and revisit and say, hey, this has gotten bigger or this has gotten smaller because treatments were done. So we haven't, the gamification part is on the horizon. It's getting enough baseline data in enough places where we can effectively do that, where you could go in and here's your points and you go check these for us, because they're in the back country and they're hard to find and you know, there's not enough staff to do it out there, to go out there and do it with these agencies. So we need these citizen scientists, community scientists to be able to come in and help us solve this problem. And it's working in other fields. We've just got to get enough awareness of the problem to get it to work in this field.
So Chuck, you mentioned a lot about partnerships and growing the community that are using these apps, but a lot of our listeners work in the weeds. So those professionals that are listening, are there any opportunities or announcements that you want to share from UGA Bugwood or the center?
Absolutely. So one of the things we are working toward is hosting this, our first ever, we're calling it our Wild Spotter Invasive Species Ambassador Training Course. It's a big name, but it's focused on this Wild Spotter program and getting the people working in the weeds, getting people working on the ground levels together, and then not training them on how to identify and control invasive species, but training them on how to market their program, how to raise money for their program, how to maintain volunteers, how to build these partnerships and learn from each other. So we've got the best of the best from inside the invasive species world who are really doing innovative work, as well as we found some outside speakers who are experts on these other areas. And so we're going to do 2.5 days, two and a little bit of a day of training, and then they're going to sit down, do a scenario about a problem somewhere in the United States, and work as a team to solve that problem, present what they would do, and then we're going to give awards and recognize it. So it's the first time we're doing it. It's December 5th through the 7th in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. The website is invasivesfree.org. And anybody can go and apply to be part of it. And we're doing this in partnership with the U.S. Forest Service and Invasive Plant Control Incorporated, a company out of Tennessee, and a lot of partners, including the Center for Aquatic and Invasive Plants at the University of Florida. So another great opportunity where we're working together on something. Dr. Stephen Enlow is one of the keynote speakers for this meeting and is going to talk about kind of the basics of invasive species to kind of make sure there's that primer there if there's somebody that's not an invasive species professional, because we don't even see this being limited to those invasive species professionals. It's more of, if you're the partnership manager for a national park, you should be there because there's going to be skills you can learn from there.
Well, right back to what you were talking about earlier, you've got to have those skills to engage. This problem is big. It's never going away. And figuring out how to get people to understand, to catch the fever that they need to be a participant in this issue is fantastic. Chuck, I'm really glad to see that the Center for Invasive Species and Ecosystem Health is continuing to push this message, not just in the Southeast, but nationally, and continuing to cement itself as a leader and a leading voice on invasive species across the country. So a lot of good coming out of the University of Georgia program there.
Yeah, and Chuck, would we be able to include the registration link in the bio that you just mentioned so that listeners can go and apply?
Yes, absolutely, yes. Where we can make sure that that's available. And if you go to Wild Spotter or if you go to invasivesfree.org, then either one of those, you can get in more information and see the agenda and the speakers for the short course, training course that we're hosting.
Well, Chuck, we really thank you for being with us today, participating in this podcast, talking about all the great things y'all are doing. But more than anything, what I appreciate is there's a lot of people that say, hey, invasive species are problematic, but very few take the next step to really actively promote how these things are destructive and help people get to work in addressing the problem. And you have done that as good as anyone in the country. You're a great example and an ambassador about how we can address these things. So thank you for being that example for us today.
Thank y'all for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you all so much for listening to Working in the Weeds. If you have any questions or suggestions for the podcast, email us at caip@ifis.ufl.edu. And you can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. Thank you for joining us as we continue to work on turning science into solutions.